Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, we're going to spend the rest of the hour wrapping up our special series, Driving Us Crazy. WBUR has been exploring all aspects this week of Greater Boston's traffic woes, the infrastructure problems that come along with it, the lack of reliable transit, the health and economic effects of those long commutes. So today, we're going to explore in depth what could be a major part of the solution: self-driving vehicles. Now, I say could be because, yes, the technology is coming. There is no doubt about that. But how we as a society adopt autonomous vehicles, the laws and policies we form around them, and how we deal with the potential economic and social downsides of the technology, well, those questions remain unanswered. So in a moment, we're going to talk with three of the nation's leading thinkers on self-driving cars. But first, let's listen to what it's like to take a ride in one right now in this excerpt from a report by WBUR's Bruce Gellerman.
Digital driverless vehicles. Sound idyllic? Unrealistic? Well, part of that future is on the road right now.
I got the Tesla for environmental reasons primarily, but it's also the safest car on the road.
Jeff Manning owns a Tesla Model S. The electric car has zero emissions and already incorporates many of the advanced technologies futurists say will help untangle traffic and perhaps even eliminate road fatalities. Nearly 90% are driver-related. The luxury sedan has a longer range than other electric vehicles, and it does what few other cars today can do. It's a semi-autonomous vehicle. When the autopilot software is switched on, computers and sensors take over. The car drives itself. You said it, but don't forget it.
The driver doesn't need to be laser focused on the road. They can be focused on the road, but not laser focused. You're not steering using the brake only if it's a red light.
Want to take him for a spin?
Absolutely.
As Manning reaches for the door, sensors anticipate his approach. The handle pops out to meet his hand. And like magic, the rearview mirrors unfold. Automotive history fades into the distance. The future is automated.
Hey, buckle in. Okay, let's...
All right, let's do it. Now, the car is on. You can't hear anything, but the car is on right now.
The car is on.
The car is on right now. So I'm going to push the brake so we can get in gear.
0 to 60 in under 4 seconds. Heading east on Route 20, the car's radar and laser systems sense the surrounding vehicles. Manning sets the speed and distance he wants to be from the car in front and flicks on the autopilot software. Sensors lock onto the painted lines on the roadway, keeping the car in the middle of the lane. Jeff Manning puts his hands on his knees, turns to me, and smiles.
Your hands are off the wheel.
My hands are off the wheel. I'm not pressing the brake. I'm not pressing the accelerator. The cars in front of us are slowing down. We're slowing down.
Traffic speeds up. We speed up. Manning signals. When the car senses it's safe, it switches lanes all by itself, merging with traffic seamlessly. Every once in a while, autopilot reminds Manning to touch the steering wheel. The car is checking to make sure he's still attentive and ready, just in case.
I think the steering wheel at some point will go away, and you will type on a screen or say out loud, take me to so-and-so, and it will take you there. It's the future, it's the safety, it's the environment, it's all wrapped into one.
That's Jeff Manning taking WBUR's Bruce Gellerman for a spin in his Tesla Model S. You can hear Bruce's entire report at WBUR.org. So we are talking about self-driving cars, and I'm curious, listeners, what are your hopes, your fears, your concerns, your ambitions for self-driving cars? There are certain models on the road already. They're going to be much more available in just a couple years. How could they transform the Boston of the future or any city of the future? So call us with your thoughts on this at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Now, our Driving Us Crazy series comes as WBUR launches Bostonomics, our new initiative on the region's innovation economy. economy. So joining us now are two of the nation's leading transportation innovators. They both happen to be Cambridge-based. Brian Reamer is the director of the New England University Transportation Center at MIT. He researches driver behavior in autonomous vehicles. Brian Reamer, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Thanks for having me this morning, this afternoon.
It's great to have you. Also with us is Robin Chase, co-founder and former CEO of Zipcar, now the largest car-sharing company in the world. She's also founded Buzzcar and GoLoco, an online ride-sharing company, and co-founded Venium, a vehicle communications company that's, quote, building the networking fabric for the Internet of Moving Things. Robin Chase, it's great to have you back on the show.
It's lovely to be here.
Okay. So I personally am quite excited, but also somewhat worried about the future when it comes to self-driving cars. Brian Reamer, can you just first give us a quick description of the state of the art? I mean, how close are we to having fully autonomous vehicles on the road and available for consumer purchase?
Well, I think we're quite a bit of ways from having fully autonomous vehicles on the nation's roads in great populations. I think we're going to see them in small ecosystems quite quickly. But what we will see dotting the nation's roads all over the place very quickly is vehicles with automated driving capabilities like the Tesla that Bruce got a ride in through his segment, where the driver no longer has hands on the wheel, feet on the pedals, responsibilities for aspects of the driving task.
Hmm. And so, Robin, do you agree with that? That, I mean, we're already in the world of sort of, let's say, driver-assisted technology?
I think I would take Brian's little caveat about in certain areas. I think we will see, Google and Tesla have said that we will see fully autonomous cars by 2020, and I see in urban areas that would be maybe geo-fenced, I see that completely likely and probable.
Mm. I also have found some research here that says that the driverless car market is predicted to be worth some $42 billion just by 2025, Robin, so a huge amount of growth.
Yeah, I see it as completely transforming city life, and we just heard, you know, what it would feel like to be in one of those cars that's partly driven, but what really makes me look forward to that future with anticipation is how we could imagine cities today, what they would look like. And so there's been a number of studies, the most recent one by the OECD, that was looking at how we come into this new world. If autonomous vehicles in cities, they are shared cars, just like Zipcar, but more importantly or more excitingly, if we just rent a seat in that shared car, we only need 10% of the cars that exist today. So just picture our cities with no on-street parking, parking garages that could be repurposed for green space, low-income housing, or whatever in heck you want, how transforming that would be. And these trips in these shared autonomous vehicles would be the price of a subway ride. So point-to-point, same amount of time you drive a car, but a subway price.
Yeah. So Robin, hold that thought for a minute, because I do want to come back to sort of this big picture of how can these this technology transform cities. But Brian, I wanted to actually ask you a quick question about the specifics of your research right now, because you're looking at driver response while they're in autonomous vehicles. And so that implies that there is still some sort of driver interaction. What have you found so far?
Yeah. And our work is really at the infancy of trying to understand how people relinquish control and take control back from highly automated driving situations such as Tesla, such as some of the other vehicles that are rapidly coming down the pipeline right now. So when you're in a vehicle that really fundamentally changes our relationship with the driving experience and relieves you of most of the operational control, many of us are giving control to the vehicle to enable us to do other things. What are those other things? How do we thread those other things, hopefully safely, through our responsibilities to oversee the automation, to take charge in situations where the automation may not be fully capable, and perhaps get more seamlessly from point A to point B as we desire increased mobility with reduced operational responsibility? And I do think it is an open question as we look to the future whether urban congestion will grow or decrease.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I firmly agree with Robin that shared car models are going to have a dramatic impact on the city culture. There are some societal characteristics of car ownership that do need to be broken further. And the fact that I can now move without physically having the responsibility to operate the vehicle, or soon will be able to, will perhaps change the dynamics of where many people would like to live.
Right. So let me just jump in here, because I want to get Robin Chase's response to this line of thinking that you're presenting, Brian. Robin, what do you think?
A lot of different issues, Brian, when I think about what you said. One is this idea of me at high speeds taking over a car feels to me horrific as a future. I think about how often I drive, and the reason I could take over in an emergency situation is because I had driven in tricky situations. But I look at my son, the only one I have who has a license, and with his 1,000 miles all told ever driven behind him, there's no way that he could, in a scary situation, be told to take over now. Then the other piece about, how the demographics of cities and shared cars, I was just thinking about the other day that people who are probably less than 35 would rather be online than actually driving. Mm. And people who are older than 75, or let's say I'll go to 80, would rather have someone else be driving them than them driving themselves. So this idea about a love affair with driving, and particularly in cities, I don't think there ever was a love affair with driving. So when I look at cities, I don't see any doubt in my mind that everyone would rather have a shared autonomous vehicle than some other method.
So, but you keep saying shared, because what about Americans' love affair of just car ownership? I honestly, even though I love, and full disclosure, I am a Zipcar member and have been for 10 years, so full disclosure there. But I honestly don't see America's falling out of love with owning their own vehicle anytime soon.
I feel like I'm the right person to be talking to that point. So if we look at dense urban areas, people who don't need cars to get to work, they're financially crazy to own their own car. And when we have these autonomous vehicles where instead of paying $9,000 a year on average, which is what people spend on their cars, you can do that exact same mobility form and make a number up, $2,000, wouldn't you rather do that? I mean, people are really financially driven, which is what we've seen with Zipcar. And so people who love their cars, in cities, they'll be sitting in their expensive parking spot and they'll be watching all their friends go around for a fraction of the price without having to maintain it, and it'll be safe and easy.
Hmm. Well, go, Brian Reimer, you want to jump in there.
Yes, I'd like to, because I think Robin's got a good point. I think in the cities you will see a very mixed fleet between car sharing, car ownership. But we also have to remember that in the heartland of America, that car ownership is still a lot like it used to be. Ford, the F-150, is the highest gross selling vehicle in America. Farming Midwest is going to resonate around car ownership for a considerable period of time. So what we're going to see is a very mixed use case, perhaps more mixed than we've ever considered in the past, where there will be more car sharing than we can imagine. But there will also continue to be large cohorts of the population for a considerable amount of time that are still in that personal vehicle ownership model.
Hmm. I agree with that.
Well, I'm going to ask both of you here to just stand by a second, because we're going to take a quick break here and come back in just a moment. Brian Reimer is the director of the New England University Transportation Center at MIT, and Robin Chase is founder and former CEO of Zipcar and a transportation entrepreneur. We're talking about autonomous vehicles, self-driving vehicles, and the near future in which many, many more of them might be on the road, and how that will transform the city of the future and transform our traffic woes. So call us with your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Now, I can see why some people out there wouldn't want a car that drives itself. Some people don't want to lose what they call the joy of the road, that uniquely American feeling of independence when you got one arm out the window, you know, the other hand on your Slurpee, your knee on the wheel right here with your eyes scanning the horizon for cheap fireworks.
Stephen Colbert there on the myriad joys of driving badly. But more seriously, take this number. In 2014, the last year for which data was available, more than 32,000 people died in auto accidents in the United States. So there's the other side of the story. We're talking about the near future of self-driving cars and how they might transform for better or for worse greater Boston's traffic problems and how they might help define the city of the future. We're being joined by Robin Chase and Brian Reimer. And let's take a quick call here. Phil is calling from Danvers. You're on the air, Phil.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's your thought today?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about something that nobody really considers, and that's issues of privacy. There's a great deal of data that goes back and forth in order to make these things work. There's voice recognition, there's the maps, and there are very few agreements in America in particular that we have that restrict the way that data is used. So, for example, if you spend twice a month in a cancer clinic and your employer has a legal way of purchasing that information, maybe you don't get that promotion because they're worried about you.
Right. Phil, I'm going to take it back from you because you present a really interesting point that I want to turn to our guest. Thank you so much for your call. Brian Reamer, your thoughts about that, because, I mean, it is data. It's big data, too, coming from vehicles.
It's very, very big data. And I think we're going to have to wrestle with some of the societal risks and benefits of the transmission of big data across networks. We do give privacy away every day for convenience. It's called the credit card. We are willing to give where we shop, where we move, away to the credit bureaus for the convenience of a cashless society. I think it's a benefit cost trade-off. I think we will give a lot of privacy out to move in much more liberating ways.
Robin Chase?
That's an interesting comment that you made, that we have done, we are doing, giving away a lot of big data, and that needs to be corrected today and in the future. That are, if you think of those 33-page terms and conditions that no one ever reads, we really need to be moving to something that's, you know, six quick icons that says, how long you can hold my data? Can I have it back? Are you going to sell it? So that we could actually understand what was going on, because I think there are ways to, I'm generating the data in my car or in my trip, and there is no reason that they actually do need to be keeping it for longer than the next 12 hours. And
is there no reason? I mean, because I don't imagine how Waze operates without like these vast troves of data about how people are driving today. How is that an app like that even functional?
With Waze, people understand completely that that's what's happening, and people have opted in. But and with Waze, it could be taking away, you know, lots of the personal data piece, which would be my guess.
Okay. Well, Robin and Brian, stand by here because I want to introduce another guest into this conversation, because just this week, some of the world's biggest and most influential companies that are developing self-driving technology, they came together to form an advocacy coalition. Google, Ford, Uber, Volvo, and Lyft announced the Self-Driving Coalition for Safer Streets, and David Strickland is the coalition's counsel. He's also former head of the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and he joins us now. David Strickland, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Meg. Thank you for having me.
So this is a very fascinating moment for autonomous vehicles. Can you tell us what you think, policy-wise or vis-a-vis regulation, are the major hurdles before we see them all over the roads of America?
Well, there's two real streams you think about in terms of regulation. There is the federal safety regulations, known as the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, where portions of the technology regarding self-driving don't exactly fit well. And my old agency is working through guidelines and guidance and possible new authorities to deal with that. Then on the other stream, you have the state police power, how to license, you know, the driving behavior parts that we try to regulate. And so with how do you deal with self-driving vehicles that don't have a driver in terms of how they comport those rules of the road and those other activities. So those are the two big mainstreams. There's lots of others.
Okay. Well, you know, Robin Chase earlier was talking to us about basically we're at a, to use a cliche, we are at a fork in the road. We can either create policy and regulations that leads us down to a heaven or nirvana of self-driving vehicles to really transform our society for the better, or hell, in her words. I mean, what direction do you think we're headed in?
We are aiming for heaven, but unfortunately, the way the regulatory framework is working out right now, we're getting different and diverging policies from states. And that, I wouldn't necessarily call it hell, but I think we'll call it very delayed heaven. It'll make it very hard to get fully self-driving vehicles out to the broadest number of people possible and get those benefits. And the hope is to have one uniform set of regulations and laws so that everybody knows what to do, and we can get these vehicles out on the road as quickly as we can.
Okay, but let me ask you, one uniform set of regulations and laws seems to me another way of saying disempowering the states from setting their own policy. I mean, that's a very tough road, or you know, a very tough road to hoe.
No, actually, I don't think it is. I mean, there are some basic foundational things, just as you think about driving, you know, in the United States today with a regular vehicle. Some, you know, cities and localities, states allow right on red, some don't. You know, but the basic core of the driving task in terms of stopping at red lights, going on green, understanding what a yield sign is, some basic foundational things that allow operation and, you know, negotiating the rules of the road exist. We are looking at the same thing as the coalition, is that there may be some variances which are manageable, but if there's basic core things that prevent self-driving, full self-driving from happening, such as having to have somebody permanently seated in the driver's seating position and things of that nature which will foreclose full self-driving, that's problematic.
Okay. Well, let me get some reaction here from Robin and Brian. I mean, David Strickland there was talking about, for example, California, which has proposed barring self-driving cars that don't have steering wheels or pedals or a licensed driver ready to react if necessary. But on the other hand, I also see that, just in February, the NHTSA said that artificial intelligence systems that are piloting the self-driving Google car could be considered a driver under federal law. So, Brian, I mean, just in those two examples, we see the state and federal tension at play in this issue.
Yeah, and I think the really hard part is we can't predict what the future is going to look like 6 months, 12 months, 5 years down the line. And when regulation is set in stone, it gets very difficult to change. So I think we got to be very careful in how legislation is enacted. And I do think the states absolutely need to be thinking together here. We need to move traffic code, traffic law to be much more of a law of the land as opposed to the law of the state. We can't, as we begin to program our way through automated vehicle development, really have differences and major differences in traffic law as we cross state boundaries. But it does change dynamically the financial model. States have huge financial revenue streams from vehicle register, operator licensure, traffic code enforcement that all begin to change around. So it's a battle of the buck at the end of the day.
I mean, we looked up the numbers for Massachusetts, and in fiscal year 2013, just from tolls and the gas tax, the state brought in $1 billion. I mean, Robin Chase, how does that – that's a huge revenue stream, as Brian Reamer tells us. How do states recoup that?
Well, I look at it as an opportunity. The whole gas tax, as we know, hasn't been changed since 1991, and it's desperately in deficit, which is why this state, like across the United States, has all those D-class bridges that none of us want to be driving on. So I say, whoa, how incredible. If we had electric autonomous vehicles, this is an opportunity to rethink all of those bad tax decisions that we made when we didn't know better and when it was simple. We didn't have the tools we have today. So let's address, let's start having user fees by distance. Let's talk about congestion pricing. Let's talk about fuel. So we can really write the things that we know are broken today with our system. And it's had to be done before.
So at the same time that we're supposed to be rewriting regulations,
yes,
for the actual operation of these self-driving vehicles, we're also supposed to be rewriting transportation financing for the nation.
One of the reasons, if I look at these cities, and it's interesting how quickly will these happen, but I'm very interested in seeing pilots very quickly. And I think in cities they'll be widely adopted. But if we want this heaven and we want it to happen sooner than later, it's going to have a very fast impact on this revenue stream. So I think we do need to get ahead of it.
Well, let's take a quick call here. Dylan is calling from the South End. You're on the air, Dylan.
Hi, I'm Dylan. I'm 24 years old. I live in the South End. I just wanted to say that I think I'm in extreme support of driverless cars. I think I drive about 4 hours a day, and I think on 93, most of the accidents are human error, and I think the traffic would go a lot more smoothly on the highway if it was driverless cars. And then the other point is that I could get a lot more things done during the day if I could be writing emails for work or doing other work activities while I could be driving to my destination.
Right.
So
Dylan,
I'm in total support.
Dylan, thank you so much for your call. David Strickland, in Dylan's example, it suddenly got me thinking, say someone like Dylan is doing exactly, you know, 10 years from now, what he was talking about, going to work in an autonomous vehicle, reading his emails, etc. You know, we don't ever want this to happen, but a crash does happen. There's also this huge question of legal liability. I mean, and we haven't worked that out yet in any shape or form. Is the auto manufacturer liable? Is the person who was in the car? Is the code writer? I mean, how do we work that out?
That is a great question. In terms of dealing with liability issues, many manufacturers that are working on self-driving vehicles have already stated that if it is an issue with their self-driving system, they will accept responsibility. And I know all of the members of the coalition have made statements to that effect. But ultimately, this is going to be issues that are going to have to be, unfortunately, worked through the courts when you actually have a situation where you're not sure if it was it the machine, was it the code, was it a human being that actually made those decisions, having to find evidence, and then, you know, figuring out from a product liability standpoint how that falls through. I will say, just as, you know, just purely, I don't see there being a wildly different model than we see today in terms of product liability. Even though the product is much, much smarter and, you know, it basically takes over an entire task, I think the financial responsibility laws are really dealing with driver behavior and making sure you're compensating people for loss. So I don't think there's this huge new framework that has to be built, but it's definitely going to have to be tweaked.
Brian Reamer, let me hear your thoughts on that. Brian, are you still there?
Yeah, I just got cut off.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to ask you about your thoughts about this question of liability.
So I do think there's going to need to be some major changes in liability. I do agree with David, though. It's going to be some time. I think you're going to need to change the product liability laws over the course of decades here. If I am not responsible for driving anymore and someone is taking that responsibility, it's going to go up the food chain, if I could use that metaphor. And then there's probably a couple Supreme Court cases that are going to have to be settled on these issues.
Mm. Well, Robin, can I ask you about that? Because you were shaking your head no as I was even asking the question of liability.
If we think about accidents today in regular cars versus accidents in the future in these autonomous vehicles are the most instrumented forms of travel. So we're going to have photographs. We're going to have second-by-second recounting exactly what happened, when, how, where, the whole surround. And I think that liability will fall out quite quickly. And we know there's going to be 35,000 fewer traffic deaths. So I see liability actually and the cost of insurance dramatically falling.
Hmm. Let's take another call here. Alex is calling from Medford. You're on the air, Alex.
I just have a couple of questions. And I understand that there's hurdles to jump over to get this self-driving car in place. I'm just wondering, is that really the direction we want to go in keeping cars and, you know, not really focusing on sustainability as an entirety, you know, like with more transit or solar wind-powered things, you know, something that's sustainable?
Hmm. Alex, thank you so much for your call. Great question. And David Strickland, let me just start with you. I mean, Alex is questioning that, you know, the fundamental premise that cars of any sort should be part of our future.
I think generally the notion that individual mobility will go away in the United States, I don't think it's a correct notion. I think what you're trying to do is try to build a mix of opportunities and choices for people so they can make wiser, more environmentally friendly and safer choices. You know, to say that individual mobility, having you know, being in a car completely goes away, it isn't really going to work. That's how people sort of live their lives in the United States. But if you have, you know, self-driving cars as a last mile solution paired with transit, you know, as Robin and Brian were talking about here, actually having, you know, ride sharing being more prevalent, which means you're going to need a smaller car fleet all around. I think self-driving actually solves a number of the issues that the caller talked about more so than continuing the problems of individual mobility. Actually, self-driving really does solve for X in so many ways that we can't anticipate.
Well, let me ask you a quick question then, because, again, Robin got us started with this idea that maybe we shouldn't have individual ownership of autonomous vehicles in the future. We might see more fleets of rental autonomous vehicles or car or shared autonomous vehicles, that kind of thing. Would that be a vision that you and the coalition, the Self-Driving Coalition for Safer Streets, would be in agreement with? Or do you still think that there has to be individual ownership of autonomous vehicles?
The coalition really thinks that there should be opportunities across the spectrum, whether you want to participate fully in a ride-sharing universe, that you live in the middle of San Francisco and you never want to own a car, versus a person who wants to have more control of their time or their schedule and more reliability, and they want to own something. You know, but I think ultimately the inline question is making sure that self-driving vehicles are available to all applications and uses that people want them, and then the market will figure itself out. Mm.
Brian Reamer, we've just got a couple seconds to go, but one last question for you. I'm seeing a poll conducted by AAA just in March that concluded that 75% of their respondents were still afraid of self-driving vehicles. What does that tell you?
I think the trust and the need to build trust in these technologies is huge. I do not think we are going to see a universal adoption of these technologies because of trust and worries and fears in technology. But I think that'll happen over time. It will take decades to change the motor vehicle fleet in the U.S. from one of primarily manually driven vehicles today to one that resembles a much more mixed fleet that we're talking about.
Decades. I wonder, Robin, do you think it'll take decades?
In cities, I think it'll take a decade.
Just one decade. Okay, so we'll see. We got 10 years in front of us. Robin Chase, founder of Zipcar, thank you so much for joining us today. And Brian Reamer, director of the New England University Transportation Center at MIT. Pleasure to have you as well, Brian. And David Strickland, counsel and spokesperson for the Self-Driving Coalition for Safer Streets and former administrator of the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you all for your input on what you'd like to see the Boston of the future be like when it comes to traffic and transportation. Keep your comments coming. Send us tweets at Radio Boston or go to WBUR.org to listen back to our entire series, Driving Us Crazy. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.